From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, in for Terry Gross. Today, A. Scott Berg talks about his biography of U.S. President Woodrow Wilson, who kept America out of World War I during his first term, but in his second term, Wilson said we had to make the world safe for democracy. He won the vote to go to war, but afterwards...
Wilson goes back to the White House and just weeps. He knew he was signing the death warrants for hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of men.
Berg's biography of Wilson is now out in paperback.
Oh, you are my sunshine.
Also, we remember Gerald Wilson. The band leader, composer, and arranger who worked with Ray Charles and others died Monday at the age of 96. We'll hear part of the interview Terry recorded with Wilson in 2006. And David Edelstein reviews The Drop, the last movie to feature James Gandolfini. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley, sitting in for Terry Gross.
Today is the happiest day of the year for me. Today is the day that in 1924, Woodrow Wilson died, that son of a bitch. And I'm happy.
That was Glenn Beck, recorded in February 2012. It was hardly the only time he railed against America's 28th president, Woodrow Wilson. It's just one example, a particularly colorful one, of how Wilson has remained a divisive figure even though he left the White House back in 1921 after serving two terms. He signed into law a progressive income tax and oversaw the creation of the Federal Reserve Bank. He ran for re-election with the slogan, "He helped keep us out of war, World War I." But in his second term, he led the country into that war, saying we had to make the world safe for democracy. That ended America's isolationism and ushered in a new era of American military and foreign policy, an era that is increasingly controversial and complicated even today. Today's guest, A. Scott Berg, has written a biography of Wilson, titled Wilson, which is now out in paperback. Berg is the first scholar to have access to two sets of papers, hundreds of Wilson's personal letters, and the papers of Wilson's doctor and close friend, Carrie Grayson. Berg also is the author of a Pulitzer Prize-winning biography of Charles Lindbergh. His biography of editor Maxwell Perkins won a National Book Critics Circle Award. Terry Gross spoke with A. Scott Berg last year.
A. Scott Berg, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. Very happy to be back with you.
So since Woodrow Wilson remains so controversial, tell us what he represents to the right, or what you think he represents to the right.
Well, I'm not entirely clear, but I think here we are a century after Wilson's inauguration, and I think he still remains the most successful, extremely progressive figure we've had in American politics. He certainly redefined the role of government, the federal government most particularly, in our daily lives. And I think this is, I think both those things, his success and that intervention, is what makes the right so crazy. This is just a personal comment, but I think maybe there's just a little too much idealism to Woodrow Wilson as well. But I don't want to characterize the right as being unidealistic.
So you think that the progressive politics and his success at pushing through some of his progressive agenda is what he's admired for and what he's hated for?
I think yes, on both counts, because it was a new way in which the government was functioning, and the government had greater latitude in our daily lives.
So let's talk a little bit about some of the economic reforms that he pushed through. When he's elected, his priority is an economic agenda and what he describes as the new freedom. What were some of the things that he advocated and then got passed through Congress?
Yes, this new freedom we hear about, which was the moniker attached to his administration, was almost entirely an economic freedom that he was talking about. And largely, and this is a theme that runs throughout Woodrow Wilson's life, Wilson believed in leveling the playing field. He believed this when he was fighting the club system back when he was the president of Princeton University, but he was also fighting it throughout his administration. He wasn't just a trust buster. He wasn't anti-big business. He was a man, however, who felt every American should have an equal shot at opportunity. So that being the case, the very first thing he came in with on his new freedom agenda, and this doesn't sound very sexy, but it had to do with tariff reform. And he just felt that with the tariffs, the way they were being operated, the way they were being manipulated by a lot of rich senators, in fact, the average American was paying more than he should be. And he wanted to lower those tariffs and ultimately get rid of a lot, if not most of them, and replace that with an income tax, a graduated income tax, in which there would be, and this is another bugaboo for the right wing, I think, a redistribution of wealth. So that was the first item on the bill.
And I should say, he thought the tariffs were protective tariffs, that they were there so that American manufacturers could charge higher prices because imports would be even higher priced.
That's exactly right. And yet there were commodities such as sugar, in which, you know, everybody used sugar but was paying something for it. And Wilson's idea was if we can lower the tariff on sugar, on cotton, on wool, and so forth, then people can buy goods that they use and need regularly and not be taxed that way. And doesn't it make more sense in leveling the playing field, he thought, if indeed the richer people were paying more on their income? So that was the tariff reform. Perhaps the most important legacy from the new freedom was the Federal Reserve System, which Wilson felt very strongly about. And this was a kind of way in which the federal government could at least have some oversight. You know, there had been a panic in 1907. And in fact, a few millionaires really bailed out the United States of America. Banker J.P. Morgan had really more economic power than anybody in the world at that point. And this really seemed terrifying to Woodrow Wilson. And once again, he wanted to redistribute some of the wealth. He wanted to take some of the importance that these few East Coast banks had, and he wanted to give people in the South, farmers in the West, and so forth, to have greater opportunity to borrow money and basically to have credit.
And the Federal Reserve Bank is still controversial. There's a movement on the right to abolish the Federal Reserve.
Well, there you have it. You know, we're 100 years later, the right is fighting Woodrow Wilson yet again.
So the things that you mentioned, he succeeds in getting passed by Congress. The end of the tariff, the start of a progressive income tax, the start of the Federal Reserve Bank.
He succeeds in a big way. And one of the interesting things also has to do with the way in which he did it. And Wilson really came in and redefined presidential power and the way it could and perhaps should be used. Wilson, you have to remember, was a student of government, of American government. He had written a dozen books, basically, on the way the American political system and governmental system worked. In knowing that, he felt the presidency was largely undefined, and he thought it could be the most important position in the United States government, but at that point, the Senate really was controlling things along with the House. Wilson believed that the two branches of government, that is, the executive branch and the legislative branches, should cooperate. And I mean that quite literally. They should cooperate the government. And as a result of that, Wilson brought a whole new style of being the executive to the United States. For example, whenever he had a really important measure to discuss, such as tariff or the Federal Reserve System, he would leave the White House, come down to the Congress. He would call a joint session of Congress. I mean, imagine the president called 25 joint sessions of the Congress during his administration. And then he would hang around. He didn't just deliver a speech, which presidents had not done in person for over a century, not since John Adams had left office in 1801. So in these visits Wilson would pay, there is a room in the Congress called the President's Room. It's a room that nobody has ever used except Woodrow Wilson for ceremonial purposes. Wilson used to come down to this president's room, which is literally just feet off of the Senate floor, and he would sit there sometimes 4 or 5 times a day after he had given an important speech. And he would twist arms. He would capture senators as they walked out. He would invite them in. He would have long conferences with them. He would horse trade. He would do anything he conceivably could to pass this agenda.
And speaking of his agenda, one more thing on his agenda I want to mention, because it again has such parallels to today, campaign finance reform. He wanted to prohibit any corporation from contributing to a campaign fund and wanted to limit personal campaign contributions. Did he succeed?
Well, not really. To some extent, he at least put the idea out there and he stuck to it. But here we are still fighting about this. But it makes the larger point, I think, however, which is that, again, Woodrow Wilson was really looking out for the average American. Wilson didn't come into politics until he was in his mid-50s, and that was largely because he had a career as a college professor, which he got shunted into, he felt, because he didn't come from great wealth. And even though, since he was a child, he wanted to serve in the United States government, he just felt that you had to be a rich man to do that. And really, he walked into government through a back door and had the most meteoric rise in American history.
Right. He was a professor at Princeton, then the head of Princeton University, governor of New Jersey for less than 2 years when he's elected president.
That's correct. It's absolutely astonishing. 20 years at Princeton alone, another 10 years in academia before that.
The new freedom, the economic agenda that Woodrow Wilson pushed through, was written with the help of Louis Brandeis, who then Wilson nominates to the Supreme Court, and Brandeis becomes the first Jewish Supreme Court justice. So we have President Woodrow Wilson, who puts a Jew on the Supreme Court, really has economic policies that he wants to support the average person in America. But when it comes to African Americans, very backwards. Let's start with Princeton. In Princeton, this is one of the only colleges or Ivy League colleges at that point that isn't admitting African Americans when he's president.
Yes, although I hasten to add that a lot of the Ivy League schools, and indeed a lot of schools in America, were not adding a lot of African Americans, but at least the doors were open. I think we have to go back a little before that, though. Well, in fact, way back, which is one has to remember that Woodrow Wilson was born in 1856 in Virginia and grew up in four states of the Confederacy. So this was a Southern boy from the Old South before the Civil War, during the Civil War, and during Reconstruction. So he grew up with a certain society. That being said, if you ask me if I think Woodrow Wilson is racist, I would say yes, of course, I think he was. If I were to ask that question of somebody 100 years ago, I think people would find him quite centrist in a way. Now, Princeton University, when he became president, was an extremely Southern college in many ways. It had half its student body was, in fact, from the South. And he was very mindful not of keeping blacks out for the sake of keeping them out, but really he just felt that society, the Princeton society, and indeed most of the country, was not yet ready for integration. And that carries through into his presidency as well. Wilson, I don't think, had any animosity toward African Americans. And in fact, when he ran for president in 1912, the African American vote got behind Wilson because he said some very positive things. He made it sound as though a door was finally going to be opened. And Wilson did say a lot of good things, but he really didn't act on them. I think largely it was political, I should say. And I think it's related to his very ambitious New Freedom agenda, for which he really needed the Southern bloc of Democrats to support him in a big way. And they made it very clear that if he was going to start integrating everywhere, he was not going to get anywhere with his agenda.
Well, he allowed his cabinet members to segregate their offices.
He did. And this is the start of the slippery slope.
And by segregate, do we mean not hiring any African Americans or keeping the African Americans in a place separate from the white staff?
That's exactly what we mean. Wilson truly did believe in advancing the African American in this country. He just didn't believe the country was ready at that time. And he often said it will take another generation or probably two generations before these things can happen. You know, it was still considered, especially in the South, just anathema for that a white woman might have to work for a black man. I mean, this was, it was unfathomable. And so Wilson's Secretary of the Treasury and Wilson's Postmaster General did integrate the Treasury Departments and the Post Office. And that did mean that they hired people, but they had lesser jobs, generally, and they worked in different offices. The sad part of this, and this is the real strike against Wilson and why the African Americans justifiably turned on him, was that there had been a few inroads made in integration in those governmental offices already. And it was a shame to see that there had been some pullback. But, you know, again, this is 50 years after the Civil War. There were still veterans alive who had fought in that war. And they just weren't ready to give in. I think they were still fighting the war.
If you're just joining us, my guest is A. Scott Berg. He's written a new biography of Woodrow Wilson. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more about Wilson. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is A. Scott Berg, and after writing biographies of Charles Lindbergh and Samuel Goldwyn, Katharine Hepburn, now he's written a new biography of Woodrow Wilson. Woodrow Wilson wins the presidency in 1912, running against Taft and Teddy Roosevelt, who ran on the Progressive Party. He pushes through some of his economic legislation that we talked about earlier. And then, you know, war is breaking out in Europe. Wilson does not want to be pulled into World War One. Why was he so adamant during his first term against being pulled into the war?
Well, I think this begins with his own childhood. Again, this was a boy who grew up in the South. He's the only president we've ever had, you see, who grew up basically in a nation that was defeated in a war, and that was the Confederate States of America. He saw cities burned down. I mean, he saw how society was completely ravaged. And, you know, he used to say, nobody needs to explain anything about the South to me. It's the one part of the country I know. And part of what he knew was that devastation. And he never wanted to see that repeated again. I mean, he really is one of the few presidents who knew what war was going to wreak. So that was one factor, I think. The second was, don't forget, we had over a century, almost two centuries, of an isolationist tradition at that point. And he wanted to avoid foreign entanglements. And I think this was a great concern. And the question was, is this an American war? And then the bigger question became, is this a war that we have to get entangled in, or are we in fact already entangled because the world has shrunk in the last 10 years? Because of transportation, communication, he's beginning to ask questions himself, whether a country, any country, certainly a growing and mighty country like the United States, can avoid international crises anymore. We have economic entanglements everywhere. We did at that point. And above all, I think Wilson felt this was not a necessary war, not just for America, but for the world. He felt a lot of it was just a lot of European posturing of these autocracies, of kings and emperors, most of whom were related. I often thought many of them were just fighting over who was Grandma, Queen Victoria's favorite grandson.
He said he saw neutrality as a badge of splendid courage of reserve moral force. And he said there's such a thing as a man being too proud to fight. There's such a thing as a nation being so right that it does not need to convince others by force that it is right. What was he talking about?
Well, I think that's pretty intense. You know, over the first few years of the war, we could stay out in the beginning, but then bit by bit, Americans were losing their lives in non-combat. That is, the Lusitania was sunk in 1915 and American lives went down. The Germans were involved in a very aggressive torpedo campaign, and boat by boat, we would lose Americans. The jingoists, such as Theodore Roosevelt, were pounding their fists to heaven and saying, we've got to get into this war. And Wilson kept urging restraint. He kept saying we must remain neutral, not just in our actions, but even in our thoughts, he said. Now, a lot of this was just Wilson posturing in his own way because he believed so deeply in keeping us out of the war. But as he later admitted, he saw the inevitability of it quite early. He was just trying to do everything he could to stall our entrance, however.
Author A. Scott Berg speaking to Terry Gross in 2013. His biography of Woodrow Wilson, titled Wilson, is now out in paperback. We'll continue their conversation in the second half of the show. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Wix.com, giving business owners the ability to create their own website with the drag and drop builder. Learn more at Wix.com. From Angie's List, offering consumer reviews for more than 19 years. And providing online shopping and scheduling for local services. AngiesList.com. And from Subaru, featuring the all-new Subaru Legacy. It's not just a sedan, it's a Subaru. Learn more at Subaru.com. This is NPR.
Coming up, we remember Gerald Wilson, the band leader, composer, and arranger who work with Ray Charles, Ella Fitzgerald, Sarah Vaughan, Dinah Washington, and others, died Monday at age 96. We'll hear part of the interview Terry recorded with Wilson in 2006. Also, David Edelstein reviews The Drop, the last movie to feature a performance by James Gandolfini. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross, back with more of Terry's 2013 interview with author A. Scott Berg. His biography of Woodrow Wilson, titled Wilson, is now out in paperback. Wilson was elected president in 1912 and served two terms. His priority when taking office was progressive economic reform, including the creation of the Federal Reserve Bank. World War I forced his agenda to change. In his first term, he maintained America's neutrality. His campaign slogan, "He kept us out of war," helped him get reelected. But his position changed in his second term.
eventually, Wilson figures America has to get involved in the war. What changes in his mind that makes war, in Wilson's mind now, the correct thing to do? After he avoided it, after he campaigned against getting involved?
Increasingly, of course, American lives were being lost, so that was definitely a factor.
At sea they were being lost?
Yes, they were being lost at sea in ships that were being torpedoed. And so innocent Americans were going down. During these years, Wilson is also building up the country through his oratory, and he's starting to build up just American morale, getting us ready for the possibility of going to war. And I think in realizing the might of the nation, he began to think of the morality of things, too. And this is the moment that really American foreign policy changes big time. And it is almost entirely Woodrow Wilson introducing, imposing, if you will, his own sense of morality, such that on April 2nd, 1917, that is just, you know, weeks after Wilson has taken his second presidential oath, he declares in a joint session of Congress that America has to go to war. And the central argument in that speech is the world must be made safe for democracy. And essentially, all American foreign policy to this day, and I mean literally today, goes back to that one sentence in that one speech. And I think this was just the growing morality within Wilson, something he always had, but he finally brought it to a point where there was a world vision attached to it.
So Congress votes to take America to war, and you're right, after Wilson wins that vote, he weeps.
He does. Wilson goes back to the White House, goes into his office, and just puts his head on the table and just weeps. And his secretary, Joseph Tumulty, was witness to that, and he said he just wept like a little boy. Again, I think he knew he was basically signing the death warrants for thousands, hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of men.
So Wilson becomes one of the main writers of the peace treaty that's approved in Paris, which incorporates his vision for the League of Nations. But in one of the greatest, like, ironies and heartbreaking scenarios of his life, the U.S. Congress never passes the treaty. We never become a signatory of the treaty. The U.S. never joins the League of Nations. Can you talk about the opposition that the treaty faced in the U.S. Senate?
It was fearsome. We think partisan politics are bad today, and they are. I don't want to be glib to say they were twice as bad then, but they were pretty terrible. And there was the Republican leader of the Senate, who was the dean of the Senate at that point, Henry Cabot Lodge of Massachusetts. I found, doing my research, that there were documents in which Lodge and a couple of other Republicans were talking about opposing any peace that Wilson brought back from Paris, no matter what it was. I think there was a great sentiment within the Republican Party at that point that basically Wilson, the Democrats, had fought and won the war. So now, by gum, the Republicans were going to win the peace. And so whatever Wilson had was simply not going to fly. That being said, I think there were certainly a lot of people who, in the Republican Party and even a few in the Democratic Party, who did not wholeheartedly embrace the treaty. It was not a perfect treaty by any means, as indeed it entailed 25 nations all contributing to this peace.
So he decides to take the issue to the American people, and he embarks on a tour trying to talk up the peace plan to the American people, and he gets really sick. He basically has a stroke. He embarks on this tour against his doctor's orders, and his doctor is a close friend as well as his doctor. What are the consequences of this stroke?
The consequences are grave, and almost sent him to his grave, in fact. Indeed, everybody advised him against going on this tour, which was a way of, he thought, circumventing the Senate. I mean, he was obviously a student of the American Constitution, so he knew all treaties had to be ratified by the Senate. But he thought if he could get popular support behind him, he could have his way. So he went on this 29-city tour, and about two-thirds of the way through, and this was the dead of summer, I mean, the heat was terrible. He was traveling by train. These were the days of un-air-conditioned trains when they were basically, you know, traveling ovens. And Wilson was just giving speech after speech, sometimes four a day, just to sell the country on his League of Nations and on the treaty in general. And indeed, just outside of Pueblo, Colorado, after he had delivered a sort of faltering speech for one of the first times in his life, he literally just collapsed on the train. And they decided, the doctor just stepped in and said, there's no more discussion here. We have to take you back to Washington right away.
Physically, he's paralyzed on one side as a result of this stroke.
Yes, he didn't have the stroke on the train, but a few days after returning to Washington, he did have a stroke. It did paralyze his left side. He did not lose powers of speech, and really his mind didn't go. And so now here's Wilson suffering physically, emotionally, to some extent we have to presume mentally as well, because even in his extremely compromised physical state, I mean, he can barely walk, and for months he doesn't get out of bed. But he's already contemplating running for a third term.
Yeah, which just struck me as just not only delusional, but unconscionable. I mean, when you're unable to function at a presidential level to consider, or hardly any level, and to consider running for president just seems so unfair to your country. But after he's incapacitated by this stroke, what you describe as a conspiracy takes over. His wife and his doctors basically agree that no one will know. No one's to know how sick he is, how incapacitated he is. The cabinet doesn't know. Does his vice president even know?
For a long time, the vice president did not know. And I do characterize it as a conspiracy. I think they considered it a benign conspiracy. It's not as if Mrs. Wilson was Lady Macbeth and was trying to seize power so that she could run the country. It was simply that she saw herself as Mrs. Woodrow Wilson, and the doctors said that any great emotional trauma is really going to affect the president's health. And she decided, well, I must do everything to keep anything that might excite him away from him. And of course, as she also said to one of the doctors, but everything a president does excites the president, because that's part of the job, is putting out fires all the time. And one of the doctors actually said, you know, he's been training you over the last few years. He's been teaching you a lot about how things work in government and in this White House in particular. And perhaps you could be the gatekeeper. Perhaps you could determine who gets in to see the president and who doesn't, which nobody did for months. But you could also read every document that comes across his desk and decide which ones he even considers.
So how much of his capacity does Wilson ever get back?
Well, he was never physically back. He remained hemiplegic for the rest of his life. He walked with a stick. Again, he could still speak, which was quite remarkable, and he could think. But the truth of the matter is he never did bounce back.
So Wilson's term ends with him being, you know, kind of incapacitated. Harding gets elected as the next president, and Wilson's popularity surges after he's out of office.
It does. Now, part of this had to do with the fact that Harding immediately revealed not only his mediocrity, but a lot less than that. And he died in office a few years later, and all sorts of corruption was then revealed. So Wilson, from the day Harding took office, was looking better and better. As Harding became so regressive in so many ways and did everything he possibly could to undo everything Woodrow Wilson had done, both economically and internationally. And I think people began to realize, you know, we had just had 8 years of Woodrow Wilson, completely incorruptible. There had never been a whiff of scandal. And people were beginning to embrace all these ideals that Wilson had been talking about. He becomes this great symbol of humanity and integrity.
Well, Scott Berg, congratulations on the book. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
A. Scott Berg speaking to Terry Gross in 2013. His biography of Woodrow Wilson, called Wilson, is now out in paperback. Coming up, a tribute to jazz composer and bandleader Gerald Wilson, who died this week at age 96. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Gerald Wilson, as a jazz composer, big band leader, and trumpet player, had a career that spanned 8 decades. Wilson died Monday after being diagnosed with pneumonia. He was 96 years old. Gerald Wilson joined the popular swing band led by Jimmy Lunsford at the end of the 1930s. Wilson was a trumpeter, but was best known for his work as an arranger, composer, and band leader. He wrote arrangements for, just to name a few, Count Basie, Duke Ellington, Ella Fitzgerald, and Ray Charles. He led his own band since the mid-1940s and kept recording. In 2006, his CD, In My Time, was described by music critic Francis Davis as his finest hour. Here's a track from it, called Jerry, composed and arranged by Gerald Wilson. When that CD was released in 2006, Gerald Wilson spoke with Terry Gross. She asked him about the start of his career when he joined the Jimmy Lunsford Band in 1939.
So I arrived here in New York. The first thing I had to do, one of the other trumpet players in the band met me, and then he took me to the tailor here in New York to measure me for my uniforms. Not one uniform, but for 7.
Were they all the same?
No, there was one with the way they ran them. It was the first uniform in the morning when we would play morning shows, before noon, we would wear the English walking suits. Yes, these are black jackets that have braid around them, and then you wear them with gamble stripe trousers. And we had all 7 different. Then the next show, which would be, might have a sporty uniform on. After that, it would be another kind of a suit. Up until the last show, which we would do 7 shows, like at the Paramount Theater here in New York, we'd do 7 shows on the weekend. And at the very end, we would have on our formal dress.
And did you like that aspect of performance?
Oh, I loved every moment of it that I spent with the Jimmy Lunsford Orchestra, making records, playing theaters, making movies. You know, we were in Blues in the Night, one of the biggest Warner Brother movies of all time. We played the Apollo 5 or 6 times a year. We played nothing but the biggest jobs, and always booked, too, by the way.
Now, you've also done arranging for singers. Some of those singers include Ray Charles, Bobby Darin, Nancy Wilson. Who else?
Well, let's get it. We'll go Ella Fitzgerald, Ray Charles, as you say, Carmen McRae, Sarah Vaughan, Dinah Washington.
How is arranging for a singer different than arranging just an instrumental for a band?
Well, the thing about the way I approach it myself, I stay out of the way of the singer. I try to, when I have to bring in the band, I bring it in. I have to, and of course, I try to use great harmony for them and to make the voice sound better. I use my 8 parts if I feel like it. And I try to many composers write numbers, and they don't know the inside of deep harmony, so you have to go in and figure that out and change it to what it should be. I do that, and as I said, working with these great artists, I just enjoy doing that. And of course, as you said, Ray Charles, modern sounds in country and western music, which I did all of the music for that. And again, I think that's a time when if they would give us a little attention and say, when he finished singing You Are My Sunshine and Bye Bye Love and all of those country tunes, yeah, I'd sure be happy if they'd said my name, that I'm the one who orchestrated it. And I'd appreciate that.
Well, why don't we hear a track from Ray Charles, Modern Sounds in Country and Western, and the music on this album was arranged by my guest, Gerald Wilson.
Yep.
That's Ray Charles from an album that was arranged by my guest, Gerald Wilson. For those of us who haven't had the pleasure of actually seeing you conduct,
yes,
what's your style of conducting?
Different from any style you've ever seen before. I move. I choreograph the music as I conduct. You see, I pointed out everything you to listen to. People can't keep their eyes off of me.
So you're making it sound like you point things out not for the benefit of the musicians, like it's your turn, read section, but for the benefit of the listener?
No, for the benefit of the listener. He sees what everything is happening, because every time I move, something happens there where I move. My hands, my two hands here, showing you where to look. If I want them to concentrate on my soloist, I concentrate on him. And they pinpoint where they're to look now and listen as they look. I think that's what I am. That's the way I can explain it. Now, I choreograph my music.
Well, Gerald Wilson, a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for talking with us.
It's my pleasure and my honor, Terry.
Gerald Wilson, speaking to Terry Gross in 2006. The jazz composer, arranger, and bandleader died Monday at age 96. Coming up, film critic David Edelstein reviews The Drop, the final movie featuring the late James Gandolfini. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. In the mob thriller The Drop, Tom Hardy plays a Brooklyn bartender beset by cops, gangsters, and whoever abused a puppy he's now caring for. James Gandolfini plays Hardy's mob-connected cousin. It was Gandolfini's final movie role. Critic David Edelstein has this review.
It's always nice when writers of the higher pulp get to class up our action movies and TV shows. And Boston native Dennis Lehane has done better than most with high-profile adaptations of Mystic River, Gone Baby Gone, and Shelter Island. He wrote for Boardwalk Empire and has now penned his first screenplay, The Drop, based on his story Animal Rescue. The Drop, by the way, is also the title of Michael Connelly's most recent Harry Bosch thriller, and I wouldn't have wanted to be in the room when Connelly got that news. The location has changed with the title, from Boston to Brooklyn, which hurts. There's something about the tribalism of Lehane's Boston Irish Catholic gangsters that can't be replicated. But at least we don't suffer any more fake Boston accents. Anyway, The Drop refers to a place where cash from all over the city gets deposited for mob bosses to collect. The location varies, and some nights it goes to a bar called Cousin Marv's, where it's handled by a mild-mannered, church-going bartender named Bob, played by Tom Hardy. Maybe you know Hardy from his muscle-bound, barely intelligible villain in The Dark Knight Rises, or this year's Locke. He's almost never the same. Apart from those pillowy lips, he disappears into every part. He's one of those actors you can't take your eyes off for fear you'll miss some wonderful detail. Here, with his light Brooklyn stammer, he sounds a bit like Jerry Lewis, but in an endearing way. He's physically unassertive. He backs away from people. But it's clear he carries secrets, maybe dark ones. Mostly, though, you see his sweet side. He finds a half-dead pit bull puppy stuffed in a garbage can and cares for it, along the way casting longing eyes on the unlucky woman whose garbage can it was, a waitress named Nadia, played by Noomi Rapace. Cousin Marv is James Gandolfini. It was his last movie role and second-to-last role, period, if you count an unshown TV series pilot. Watching him in The Drop, like watching Philip Seymour Hoffman in A Most Wanted Man, is heartbreaking. Gandolfini was at his peak. Cousin Marv is a loser with dramatic stature, a man who never recovered after Chechen gangsters took over his bar and made him an employee. Now he needs money and knows too much about a robbery of his place, which has a detective played by John Ortiz sniffing around, and more important, the Chechens, led by a fine, nuanced actor named Michael Aronov, dropping not-so-veiled threats. It's sad when Hardy's Bob finds Gandolfini's Marv in his basement man cave in an easy chair, hope visibly drained, suddenly contemptuous of his longtime ally.
Well, I'm not the guy that wasted his entire life waiting for it to start.
I did that?
Mm-hmm. At least I had something once. I was respected. I was feared. When I walked into a place people sat up, they sat up straight. They noticed. What'd you ever have? That bar stool that you put that old biddy at and bought her free drinks. And don't think I don't know that you did it on purpose. That was my stool, and nobody sat on that stool because it was Cousin Marv's stool. And that meant something. That meant something.
But it didn't. Ever. It was just a stool.
The Drop is directed by Mikhail R. Roskam, who made an excellent Belgian thriller called Bullhead, and he gives the milieu a layered, lived-in texture. But the film doesn't have a satisfying shape. Its threads aren't tightly wound. There's a psycho played by Bullhead star Matthias Schoenaerts, who factors in the climax, but until then seems peripheral. And a key plot point turns on a character who disappeared, probably bumped off, 10 years earlier, which doesn't give the narrative much urgency. Nearly every character wears a beard, which makes them hard to tell apart at first glance, apart, of course, from Hardy and Gandolfini. They're the reason The Drop is worth seeing. The movie does work splendidly as a character study of hoods who've learned to take their sorry fate as it comes versus hoods who try to change things, in most cases stupidly, and end up lying in puddles of their own blood. What can you say about a film where the pit bull is the most adorable character?
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today is Roberta Shurrock. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Molly C.V. Nesper. John Myers directed today's show. We'll close with some more Ray Charles. This is Someday You'll Want Me to Want You, arranged by Gerald Wilson. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley.
I know that someday you'll want me to want you. When I'm in love with somebody else, yes, you expect me to be true. Oh, and keep on loving you. Although I may be blue.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Nonesuch and Warner Brothers Records, featuring Lullaby and the Ceaseless Roar, the new album by Robert Plant, available now at iTunes. From PBS, With the Roosevelts, an intimate history by Ken Burns, chronicling the lives of Theodore, Franklin, and Eleanor, Sunday night at 8 Eastern. And from Source America, researching and developing employment and training initiatives for people with significant disabilities. SourceAmerica.org. This is NPR.
The Australian comedy series Please Like Me is now on the U.S. cable network Pivot TV. On the next Fresh Air, Josh Thomas talks about creating and starring in the show, realizing he was gay in his 20s, and coming out to his dad through a text message.
So I texted him, I said, hey, what time is your flight getting tomorrow? Also, I have a boyfriend. See ya.
Join us.